I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Patrick LeBrun. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. Today we're going to talk about a couple articles that you've done recently, one on the Dylann Roof shooting spree in Charleston, and the other, which is the beginning of a series of essays on the topic of lawfare. And I guess we can talk about the contrast today between warfare and lawfare, if you will, as different ways of going about the nationalist struggle in the United States. So why don't you lay out some of the connections between these two ideas, whether or not they're mutually exclusive, how they can either complement or conflict with one another, and so forth.
Right. So they are not mutually exclusive. You can pursue both at once. In fact, in the beginning of the lawfare article, I have an extensive quote from Jeremy Waldron, who's a legal scholar at NYU. He was a guest at an asymmetric warfare conference, and he talked about how there are many different methods to pursue the goals that you have. You can run for office. You can fight for it in the courts. You can, which would include just regular lawsuits as well as things that would be considered lawfare. You can do civil disobedience of varying intensities, and then, of course, there's armed struggle. And these don't happen in an A, then B, then C sort of fashion. They can happen all at the same time or moving back and forth between different approaches. And before this era of heavy electronic surveillance, it was possible to have a puppet master behind the scenes. Or you would see a very loose-knit or even unconnected constellation of actors who were united by a common vision, but who were pursuing very different means. I think now it's not possible to really have a puppet master behind the scenes just because of the aspect of electronic surveillance. But it's also very difficult to have a uniting vision that will not... let's say that you don't have those who are pursuing the nonviolent means wilt away because someone else is pursuing the same goal using the armed struggle. I think this is something that you'd see happen often, and it may be particularly the case in the United States. And in looking at the violent aspect, if you were talking about an insurgency, you talk about an insurgency with three different subsets. You have the guerrilla, you have the underground, and you have the auxiliary, which is kind of the logistics support and intelligence support for the underground. And there's a lot of separation between the three. You don't have one person, writing propaganda and then going and sneaking into a government installation and setting a bomb or something, right? They're really mutually exclusive, and the people who do each one of them is expert in different areas. And what you see in the United States, despite having thousands and thousands of trained killers, and I'm sure that a great number of them are very sympathetic with our views, that whenever violence does happen, it seems to be someone who fits the lone nut stereotype or a lone wolf. And I think that there's something essentially just ineffective about the lone wolves, or at least the way it's been done lately. And that's what I tried to look at in this, analyzing the effectiveness of politically motivated mass murder in the U.S. And I basically looked at five verticals, if you can imagine a graph, five verticals, which were picking the target, the method, operational impact, propaganda impact, and then the tempo. And then I had six horizontals, and that was a variety of these different killers over the past few years who could somehow be linked with the new right or white nationalism. Whether, we can all argue over how well each one of them links or not, but I picked these six and just looked at how horribly they failed on almost every aspect that you would look at in creating one of these events.
So what kind of reaction did this article garner? Have you been looking at your critics? Have you been responding to them?
Yeah, I haven't responded. I just looked before we began here, and I think this article has gotten around a bit more than a lot of the others I work on. And one of the critiques was kind of You know, just emotional critique. It was that they wanted, what people were craving to hear was a moral vindication of this guy, you know, Dylan Stormroof, and a, yeah, I guess also the sense that at least he's doing something, right? At least he's got the balls to do something, and, you know, we like what he says, and he's drawing attention to this. One of the others was that, you know, I didn't see this one as much, but they were saying, like, that, you know, this is a an article that's arguing against violence, but it's giving all the tools necessary to plan, you know, some kind of an attack, which I guess is true, but, I mean, that's not a reason not to talk about things. And I think, you know, I'd stick with what I said before, that, you know, if someone's not a trained killer, there's no point in even in thinking about it, because it's just so easy for them to do it wrong. You know, I tried to compare as well as looking at this this set of mass killers, also contrasting them with how professionals have handled this these approaches, both non-state and state actors. But I really try to get as many non-state actor comparisons as possible. One of the funniest ones I thought was that someone thought it was really unfair that I would compare these lone wolves to, you know, hardened, well-organized insurgency groups, which was kind of a funny approach, I thought, that I was being unfair to them, and I should only compare apples to apples. But, you know, the goal is not, in writing this, was not to morally vindicate anyone or to feel good about what they did or what they thought. The goal is to think really seriously about what's best for moving towards our goals. And I think that this approach is not what's best for moving towards our goals.
The do something argument, I always thought, was a recipe for disaster. We've got to do something. I wrote an article years ago called First Do No Harm, which is, of course, one of the principles of Hippocratic medicine. A doctor should do no harm. And that's the first order of business, is not to do any harm. And then see if you can actually do some good. And the idea of just doing something really ignores, I think, the distinction between doing good and doing harm, because they're both something, right?
And, yeah, absolutely.
You can certainly argue that Dylan Roof did something, but it's really questionable whether he did anything that ultimately is any good.
Right. To think that they can commit a capital crime and not go to jail for a long time. Because there are definitely many, many examples from the United States of politically motivated violent actors who are still in jail. You know, Mahmoud Abu-Jamal and Leonard Peltier are two examples, right?
And, of course, the Oklahoma City bomber is dead.
That's right. That's right.
It was amazing after the Oklahoma City bombing when all these mush-headed, mush-mouthed liberals suddenly found a moment of moral clarity. And they started talking about the death penalty and justice and things like that. Because, you know, he struck close to home. He struck at the federal government. And there have to be consequences for striking at our rulers, right?
Absolutely. So, yeah, the next level up would be, and this might be harder in the U.S. because there's no human rights tribunal in the U.S. that, or outside of the U.S. that's recognized. And that is that, you know, you create a situation like in Northern Ireland where you have prisoners and you have a dispute over the status of them. Are they prisoners of war fighting against an occupying army? As the you know, members of a military that finds its continuity from the days of their Declaration of Independence and their first two elections? Or are they common criminals, men of violence, right, to use Margaret Thatcher's phrase? And so... And that's kind of a, you know, an ironic case, because the position that the IRA men were taking, if they had their way, it would have been much easier to lock up more of them and to keep them in jail longer and to fight harder against them. And for the British government, if they they did have their way, and they made it much harder on themselves to fight back. But the... You know, the higher level metapolitical goal was more important, and you know, this goes back to skip back to the first article on the mass shooters. You know, one of those verticals is legitimacy, and legitimacy is so important. And you know, you you see that in these cases of a lot of the non-state actors I mentioned, even those who failed to do what they wanted to do. They start from a point of, okay, what is legitimate? And if they don't, even if they execute well, then they fail. Just finding legitimacy is key. And then putting these, so you have these prisoners in jail, they're doing civil disobedience, you have the blanket men, you have the hunger strikes, and they're being really mistreated. And this case was brought before the European Court of Human Rights and the European Commission on Human Rights. And in one case, the lower level found Britain guilty of torture and it wasn't crimes against humanity, but definitely inhumane treatment, I think they call it. And then the higher court overturned it several years later. But the impact that had to say that Britain is torturing its own citizens and locking people up without charge had a severe impact on the will to fight amongst the populace. They basically lost the left in Britain very early on because of this. And you see that, it was when the left came to power and the conservatives had failed to operationally get to a point that was satisfactory. That was when they begin the peace process and basically hand over 50% of the power to the nationalists. But it's hard to – I was trying to draw a graphic of these different things, the different verticals that I had, and it's very hard to conceptualize it because they really – some of them flow together, propaganda, legitimacy, making sure that your methods, match well with these. It's a pretty I don't want to – make it more complicated than it should be, but it really is hard to get one's head around it. Yeah, so with universal jurisdiction, this is an interesting concept, and the genealogy of it alone is interesting because it starts with, some say it starts with Nuremberg. That's not actually the case. It was a victor's court. But it indisputably starts with the Eichmann case, because here you have a... the accused is a citizen of Germany. The victims are citizens of several Eastern European states and Central European states. And the crime takes place across Central Europe. Now, a court in Israel then essentially kidnaps him from another country. As they say, the Israeli government kidnaps him in another country and then brings him to court in Israel, a state which didn't exist at that time. And so in order to justify this, you have this concept of universal jurisdiction, and that is that when you have a crime that's so grave that, if I jaywalk in New York, it doesn't impact, quality of life or dignity in or anything like this or law and order in New Jersey. And so it's natural and right that I would only be charged and ticketed and everything in the under the jurisdiction of New York. If I were to do something like, traffic drugs or people across state lines, naturally this becomes a federal issue, right? The FBI gets involved. You can go to federal court and federal jail. And so the idea is, take it to the next level. If you commit a crime that endangers all of humanity or endangers the dignity of humanity as a whole, and the just the moral ripple effects go beyond national borders, then any country who's capable ought to find this person or ought to try this person. And this is the this was the case here, and also it's often predicated on the idea that where this crime occurred, or those involved, their government in charge is either unwilling or incapable of trying this case. And so you have with the Eichmann case this creation of and putting into use of the universal jurisdiction concept. And that, once again, to use this Gollum phrase, I mean, this is another Gollum that they created. And this is has been used very, very effectively by the left in general and specifically by Palestinian groups. And they've really severely limited the travel for several years of many senior Israeli officials, because all they need is a letter from a judge saying that we find this person, or we need to inquire into whether this person committed crimes against humanity, war crimes, war of aggressions, all these kinds of crimes. And so if that person is within the jurisdiction where the judge sent out this warrant, they could be arrested, they could be called in for a pretrial hearing, and even if they're found not guilty, it's just very embarrassing for the state of Israel for this to happen. And so they've worked very hard against it. They've signed a number of bilateral treaties with various European countries to stop this, which is kind of interesting. The fact that these governments went along with it, you have to wonder why. Suddenly their dedication to human rights is secondary to their need for bilateral strategic relations, which was the phrase they would use for what they wanted to save with Israel. But this was, I think that there are opportunities as well for universal jurisdiction for our side, and that'll come out in part three. One of the easiest cases, I think, so just imagine there's a guy named Julius Malema, who is the head of the ANC Youth League in South Africa. And, I think most of our listeners are familiar that there's an ongoing genocide of the Boer folk, a white minority in South Africa. They're not the same as most other South Africans. So many South Africans who live in the cities are English descended. And then you have Afrikaners, which would be an inclusive term for both the Boers and, let's say, urbanized people with Dutch roots. And then the Boers are mainly rural farming folks. They tend to be very Calvinist and really traditional, and they're out there. They're very good at what they do. They're very good at running very large farms. And, South Africa was the breadbasket of and the fruit basket or vegetable basket of Africa. In fact, I think before apartheid ended, they made enough food to feed the entire continent if it could be properly distributed. But they're being targeted for having their land stolen from them. This guy, Julius Malema, was very fond of singing a song, Kill the Farmer, Kill the Boer, which even Mandela sang after apartheid ended at the funeral of one of his comrades. There's a pretty famous picture of him standing next to the Jewish head of the union in South Africa singing that song. And so he sings a song. He's actually been found guilty by a South African court since then, and since the murder of the right-wing leader Eugène Terblanche of hate speech. And he's also he was kicked out of the ANC. Now, I'm not sure how strong his links are with the ANC now, how close they are. But I do know that he stayed in long enough to embezzle millions of dollars during the run-up to the World Cup. And if he is a political orphan, let's say, and if he does decide that he has to take his concubines and mistresses on a shopping trip to New York or Paris, then he could very easily be subpoenaed and a warrant be put out for arrest for crimes against humanity, for all these usual things, because he is undoubtedly supporting genocide and has been actually found by a court in South Africa for committing hate speech. So all you need is a judge who's sympathetic to this cause and who's willing to put his career on the line for a politically sensitive subject. And in the United States, the way that would have to work is it has to be for damages. It can't be for a crime in the United States. In the way it works in Europe, it could be for a crime. But you'd have, say, a Boer folk who have since moved to the United States or Europe who are family members of those who have been murdered. They can bring this case in the U.S. Any Boer folk can bring a case in Europe. So that's just one way I think that universal jurisdiction could be used in our favor. And I think there are probably many others if we were to really put our minds to it.
That's really fascinating. Yeah, that is food for thought. Yeah. And there are many, many lawyers involved with the white nationalist scene in the United States.
That's great.
And yet, I have not met any of them who are talking about this, and so it's a good topic to get on the table.
Well, you know, it's a topic I can kind of, you know, not blame them, because it's a topic that's really hard to find info about. I mean, if you look at the Brookings Institution, maybe, they have a blog called Lawfare, and it has nothing to do with lawfare. I mean, it's essentially just, you know, anything that might be a little bit international law is covered on it, and it's a lot of articles that are kind of not any better written than what you'd find on Huffington Post. And then on the other hand, you have the Lawfare Project, or NGO Monitor, and these are essentially, you know, Zionist front organizations that are trying to delegitimize the concept of universal jurisdiction and the concept of crimes against humanity as applied to the IDF. So there's very, very little out there. I think probably you'd find more in Spanish about it than anything, because that's where many of the cases are from. And there's a guy named Baltasar Garzon, who was a real major proponent of it, who was a judge in Spain. But I do want to point out, so if there are a lot of lawyers out there in the U.S., for years, universal jurisdiction to get started in the U.S., you only need a lawyer. And I'll give you an example. I think anyone who's been familiar with the counter-jihad or with and concerned with the you know, Muslim infiltration, Muslim invasion, etc., they've heard about this series by Frank Gaffney, or they've heard he covers this a lot, but they've heard about the information stemming from the Holy Land Foundation case. I've been hearing about it for a long time, and you'll always hear about the unindicted co-conspirators, which is to say, you know, the impression I had was totally wrong about this case. I thought, until researching this article, that this was a case brought by the State Department, and that it was a national security case, and that it uncovered this kind of, you know, very, very sinister network. What it actually is a young Jewish American teenager who is Israeli American dual national, was in Israel, and he was killed, among some others, at a bus stop by a guy who was probably Hamas-linked. What the family did, I think it was 4 years later, 6 years later, they took the Holy Land Foundation, which was the number one Muslim charity group in the United States for about a decade at least, they took them to court for damages. They were eventually awarded, I think it was $183 million. And then a court of appeals found to be the same. They kept the same number in place, which is very interesting when you think that, you know, the families of those killed by Dylan Stormroof get $27 million, and the families of David Boehm get the family, I should say, this one young man gets $183 million. But when you look at this case, you find that it's really just the unindicted co-conspirators are in fact, you know, this is a civil case is where this stems from. And what was uncovered in the process was some accounting irregularity. And now you have and also certainly friendship with people who are Muslim Brotherhood linked and who had subversive materials in their house and subversive intentions, right? But there's nothing that links the number of those who went to jail with any of this subversion. And there's nothing that links them with the violent acts of Hamas. What you do have is they raised money that went towards food and medical supplies for Gazan children. And that's enough to link them to Hamas. I think I came across an ADL article from The Times saying that 95% of Hamas's expenditures are on social programs. And I think it was 60% of their funds come from abroad, right? And so these guys are sending in humanitarian stuff. But because, you know, once that bag of rice that they bought is, if you have that rice scooped into a bowl by someone who's linked to Hamas, then they become supporters of a foreign terrorist organization as designated by the State Department. And so that's what so much of this case against them hinges on. The president of the organization has been put in jail for 65 years as
Amazing.
A result. Yeah. And, you know, I don't want anyone to come away from this thinking that I'm not concerned about, you know, radical Islam, or that I don't think that, you know, there are many really, you know, bad folks involved with these things. But I think that this case looks pretty weak. And in fact, two of the key witnesses, I might be a first in American history, were unidentified. They were anonymous Israeli intelligence officials. And so, you know, in America, you have the right to face your accusers, except when they are members of the Israeli government. This is really concerning, and the Supreme Court has refused to hear their case. I don't want to get too, you know, diverted on this this issue, but I think the Holy Land Foundation should be very interesting to look into for people out there.
Well, it's clearly the case that anything that involves Jews and Jewish interests in Israel is going to be treated with entirely different standards of evidence and so forth by the U.S. courts. What chance do we have? What chance do we have then?
Yeah, I guess that's the thing, is that, I mean, why I bring it up is not, you know, just to point out the injustices of you know, the tribe and you know, and what the Arabs have to go through as a result. What I really want, you know, if that's all I conveyed, I would think that I've failed in writing and talking about it. What I really want to convey to people is this is how these things work, and that we need to start doing things like this ourselves. And that even if there is a double standard, which there is, we'll still be able to either at least point out to people objectively, like, hey, how come this case is treated this way and that's another, there's a double standard. And if, you know, and at best, start having some real victories against our enemies. And I think that, you know, and I guess that comes to doing something smart, you know. You know, you have to do something smart. And then either way, we'll start winning. And so this is, I hope that people consider these alternative methods.
It does strike me that the enemy has enormous advantages. And one of their advantages, though, is they often frame things in heads they win, tails we lose manners. So there's really no downside for them in these battles, right?
Yeah.
And honestly, we have the power to frame things in the same way. And something like this strikes me as one of these heads we win, tails they lose kinds of things.
Right.
Because no matter what the outcome in the court, we can still make something out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, if there's an attempt, if Julius Malema is in the United States and there's an attempt that gets any media coverage, or at least alternative media coverage, about this, and then you see that his case is treated very differently than all these others, then you can say, okay, hold on. You know, who are the people behind the scenes here enforcing this double standard? And I think that, you know, one of the things in the general public in America is that that white people are a lot more open to hearing about double standards involving Africans and African Americans. And so I think that when you talk about, you know, if this case were pursued as opposed to, say, an anti-Zionist case, that you'd very quickly find a lot of sympathizers out there.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of sympathy for people who point out Jewish double standards, too. I think double standards, just ipso facto, are morally outrageous to white people because we tend to think that sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, fairness and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, I mean, there's more to it than just pointing out double standards. As I used to say, and I don't wish to in any way impugn Stormfront, but I used to say that double standards are for Stormfront, right? meaning that Stormfront is the place where a lot of people go for the beginning of their education, and so it's sort of like elementary school stuff, right? We've got to go beyond that. But it's a great first lesson. It's a great wake-up call, which is why people keep doing it all the time.
Yeah.
Because it is morally outrageous to people. So, yeah, even if we lose, if we can illustrate double standards and illustrate bias in the political system and the court system, that's useful in and of itself. Another thing that's unfortunately true, but we have to be realistic about it, is that Americans get really excited about politics and law. And I know Americans who are, you know, bona fide, honest-to-God, national socialists, for instance, who will give more money to Republican political candidates than they would ever give to the white nationalist movement because it just gets them excited, right?
Yeah.
And legal defense funds can soak up huge amounts of money from the movement.
Interesting.
It's very unfortunate, frankly. I wish people would sign a pledge not to do this, because frankly, every few years, if the system wants or the SPLC wants, they can basically clean us out by some outrageous trial where people get shaken down for a lot of money to support somebody, right?
Yeah. It's unfortunate that it sounds like these defense cases as well, that you don't have pro bono lawyers. Because I think that a lot of the left, they depend on, the National Lawyers Guild has very few paid lawyers. Most of them just do pro bono work for the National Lawyers Guild on the side, and this tradition doesn't exist in France, but in the United States, I think it's a wonderful tradition that approximately 10% of a lawyer's time is dedicated to pro bono work. And if every white nationalist lawyer out there started applying the same standards that not just leftist lawyers, but even, the chief counsel for the local Boy Scouts, or whatever kind of group, they are all getting this pro bono from even middle of the road and apolitical lawyers. And so if white nationalist lawyers out there started doing this, then I think you'd start seeing, they can come up with things much better than I can. I'm not a lawyer. And I think we'll see a lot of interesting cases come forward. But the, about the mindset of our public, and you were talking earlier about fairness and about how they think about fair play and double standards. There was one survey I saw in the New York Times after the Eric Garner case, and I apologize for referencing the New York Times over and over again, but I get a lot of my news from there. They had a survey from of the general public, and they had a survey where they cut out just the white population and looked at them. And they compared attitudes about the Trayvon Martin case after it had finished, right? What did they think about this? And the Eric Garner case. And it was, it was a range. It was like, do you think they got the right decision, the wrong decision, undecided? I think there was one other section. But the thing that really stuck out for me was that about 40%, there's 35-40% of the white people swung from being against Trayvon to being for Eric Garner. Now, just to recap for our listeners out there, in case they missed it, the Trayvon case, here was a kid who was a petty criminal. There was a guy who was a neighborhood watch guy. He had called in a suspicious person. He was armed. And then he was attacked in the streets. He stepped out of his vehicle, and he was attacked by Trayvon, who reached for his gun, and this guy felt a lethal threat and shot and killed Trayvon. Eric Garner, a petty criminal, was caught in a sting operation by police, and the police officer did a chokehold that is against procedure for the NYPD, and then he was also very obese, and he had diabetes and all these other health problems, and then he died as a result of the chokehold. And I think that this swing of support was really interesting, because I think the key element there was that the difference between following procedure, proper procedure, and not following proper procedure. I think that was a really interesting insight into the general public of our people. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that is interesting. I thought there was some ambiguity about whether or not this was a proper or improper sort of procedure, but still accepting that it was improper.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. It also makes sense that I think a lot of people who looked at this sort of felt, well, wait a second here. The guy was essentially engaged in victimless crimes, namely selling loose cigarettes.
Right.
I'll put it this way. Selling cigarettes by the pack or selling cigarettes singly, there is a victim, namely the fool who's smoking them, but it's no worse to sell them loose than it is to sell them in packs in most people's mind.
Right.
And so I think that was sort of part of it, too.
Right.
My initial reaction was, well, it's unfortunate that was even a law, right?
Right.
But, of course, if you step back, it's like, yeah, it might be the law, it might be the sort of law that should be thrown out, but the police aren't entitled or allowed to make those determinations, right?
Yeah.
They have to enforce the laws that are on the books, and sometimes what happens when you enforce the law is even minor laws, even petty little laws like lifestyle laws and things like that, if you enforce them, things will escalate and people will die.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it was about only 20% of whites, and this is a graph I looked at, you know, 9 months ago, only about 20% of whites were against the Trayvon case results. And so, and if anything, you know, we can assume that that side is going to be inflated, because if anyone gets a call on the phone from someone pretending to be doing an anonymous survey, you know, if speaking for myself, I might just tell them what they want to hear, because I don't know who's on the other end of the phone, right? I mean, maybe I'm a bit extra cautious, but, you know, this is my approach to life, right? If someone tells me that they're, you know, totally innocuous, I don't believe them. Even if it's 20%, then it tells you that there is 1/5 of our people who are, you know, can't be saved and can't be turned, right? There are 1/3 of our people who are always going to sort of see, like, okay, you know, our side is right, or, you know, law enforcement is always right, or however they think about these issues in their mind, right? And then you have this vast middle, right? And this is a plurality where they think, okay, are they doing things the right way? Are they doing things in the legitimate way? And so, you know, again, this brings us back to that issue of legitimacy. And, you know, when I wrote about the Sikh massacre, I said that I extended my condolences to those who were the families of those shot. And, you know, I'd say the same thing to the families of these churchgoers. I mean, this is the definition of non-combatant, you know. If a guy like this, you know, if he had taken out Lindsey Graham or something, maybe I'd feel a little bit less, you know, like I need to say that, right? But I mean, and I think that I'm not very different from that vast middle ground, maybe in that point, is that, okay, there's, you know, there, you just can't, you don't go after non-combatants. Your actions have to be legitimate. You have to follow certain moral guidelines that are acceptable to our people. I guess that's part of what makes this process harder of going to the, you know, armed struggle for our race as opposed to, say, Algerians or Afghanis or any other group. Is that, you know, for them, they're a lot more quick to accept might makes right. They're a lot more quick to, go with the flow if someone else is tougher than them. Whereas ours, I think we're people who have, you know, moral standards. And so we have to understand that as we try to move the ship of state or the ship of our civilization in 180 degrees. And we have to, you know, guide our actions with this in mind, that everything we do must be legitimate and must be, you know, in some ways acceptable or understandable, at least, to this crowd that's going to swing back and forth. I'm curious to hear what you think about that, if you want to somehow, I don't know, I don't want to bind us in too tight of a corner, you know, with this kind of guideline, but, you know, I'd be curious to hear what you think about that.
You're right. I believe that, you know, whites have a particular moral consciousness. I don't think that it is entirely unhealthy, like some people would like to claim it is. I do think that Christian ethics are problematic and unhealthy.
Let's say pathological altruism, maybe.
We have a tendency to pathological forms of altruism, and that has to be reined in. However, the fact of the matter is that it's wrong to simply murder people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's wrong simply to murder people because you think it's the most convenient way of handling a problem, and I think most people accept that. I get really indignant with people because I believe in simple-minded notions like the golden rule, right? I don't see any reason. I've never seen a good reason not to believe in something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, what my moral consciousness is premised on is a recognition that I am not invulnerable, right? And that if I do wrong things can happen to me, and therefore one has to do unto others as you would have others do unto you, basically.
Yeah.
I think that's a universally valid moral premise. And the people who simply poo-poo that, well, I think there's something wrong with them. And I think that what's more to the point, most of our people think there's something wrong with that, and you're going to be a self-isolating moral imbecile if you try and buck that trend. And unfortunately, our movement attracts a lot of embittered moral imbeciles.
Yeah, I'd say without making judgments on the individuals themselves, I mean, I definitely would say that they're not going to be effective in the struggle.
They're not going to be effective. I mean, there are a lot of people who, I mean, bitterness is a huge problem for our people. It's a kind of neurosis. A bitter person is basically a person who feels victimized. And at a certain point, they say, I am not going to be a moral human being anymore. I am not going to discharge any moral obligations to anybody until the rest of the world acknowledges my pain and victimhood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, things don't work that way. And basically what happens is bitterness becomes a kind of neurosis that licenses bad behavior. You've been mistreated in the past, and so you just don't care about other people. Well, I'm sorry, but that is not a position of moral strength, and that is not a persona that has any moral authority. You're not if you're that person, you're not a person who has the power to sway our people to your side and sway our people to do what's necessary in order to liberate our race, right? Our people. You've basically thrown away a very important element of persuasiveness, which is your own ethical standing.
People don't
respect that. People honestly don't respect it. Now, I do recognize that people do have a certain sneaking admiration for scoundrels. There is some truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, people don't trust scoundrels and shouldn't trust scoundrels. There were people who had a sneaking admiration for Bill Clinton, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he was an obvious scoundrel. Well, I'm sorry, but I wouldn't buy a used car from this guy, much less let him run my country. And I think most serious, sensible people are like that. Now, there might be people who are all confused, right, in their motives. There might be people who confuse the criteria for being a leader with the things that turn bad girls on or something like that. But that is just an elementary, deep-level confusion about what are the criteria for being a trustworthy, upstanding person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it sounds like the kind of person you're describing is, you know, I remember in my youth when talking with a friend after his first heartbreak, who promises never to fall in love again and never to treat, you know, a woman with respect or love or anything.
Right.
I think we've all heard someone make that claim, and usually they get over it, that feeling, in a month or two. And they go on to have, you know, normal relationships again, but they don't hear wedding bells from the beginning. You know, I think it's a difference.
Right.
But it sounds like this kind of folks you're describing have reached a breaking point where not only are they bitter, but they're detached from humanity or the rest of our people in such a way that they can't connect with them and can't also can't have their admiration and therefore can't move our our ball down the field towards victory.
Right.
And so, you know, the question is, okay, how do we, let's say, separate ourselves from them or isolate them or what have you and you know, trim the fat and stick with those who are going to be effective.
Right.
And
right.
I'd say without saying that, you know, there's never a case where armed struggle is illegitimate. I mean, there are definitely cases where it is.
Oh, of course. Defending yourself against genocide,
yeah.
Well, there's been a very, very concerted effort to establish that as a criterion that basically gives certain people an absolute moral blank check to do anything, right?
Right.
Again, this is another golem that I think that they have allowed to escape their control. The problem with bitterness and the problem with spite, which is a related sort of vice, I guess, is that ultimately they're self-destructive.
Yeah.
Spiteful people are so angry at their enemies that they'll do things that harm themselves in order to harm their enemies.
Yeah.
We do not need people like that making important decisions, right?
Correct.
We do not need suicidally spiteful and embittered people making decisions. That's deadly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think also, I mean, I know this has been mentioned in the case of, those who want Israel to be destroyed, that they're suicidally spiteful if they're a white nationalist.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I put it this way, that a spite is basically hating your enemy more than you love yourself.
Yeah.
And it's a real emotion. I felt it, you know, and I think we have to guard ourselves against these sorts of things. We have to guard ourselves against spite, and we have to guard ourselves against embitterment.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are deeply morally deforming forces, and I see a lot of that in our cause, unfortunately.
Right. You know, I've been a regular critic of Israel and also a proponent of the boycott, divest, and sanction movement. But I'd say that, you know, for those who see that as contradictory with, you know, being against this kind of suicidal spite, I was thought about this when, my wife listens to fitness podcasts every now and then, right? And they were describing, it was a physical trainer describing how women react when he mentions lifting weights to them. And their first thought is, well, I don't want to look like a female bodybuilder, right? And then he says, well, this doesn't happen overnight. You know, looking like a female bodybuilder, it takes a long time. So, you know, lift to get strong, lift to get toned, and then stop when you feel like you've gone far enough, you know? And you can always stop lifting weights and not look like that. And you just have to decide when's the right moment. And I'd say the same thing applies to this. You know, I'm for a full court press on our primary adversary, and then we can always stop when it looks like it's going to go too far, which we're, you know, that's a long way in the future, and a lot more has to happen before we get anywhere near that, and make them choose that that battle as the one they're going to fight. Make them choose to fight over that rather than maintaining their privileged position within our societies and maintain their genocidal plots. Basically make them choose their own existence and their own, you know, Volkstadt rather than, you know, having it both ways. And so I really believe in, you know, the full court press. I just wanted to make that comparison, though.
I think that's valid. My way of formulating it is that in the long run, I want there to be an Israel for the simple reason that I want the Jews here to be there.
Right.
However, in the meantime, I want it to be as expensive and difficult as possible for them to maintain Israel, because resources are fungible, right?
Yeah.
And resources that they are constantly having to put against the boycott, divestment, and sanction movements are resources that they are not spending against us.
Yeah, right? That's right.
And they are working very actively against us, and therefore any movement that sops up their time and energy and money and emotional intensity strengthens us. Anything that weakens them strengthens us, even though in the long run, I do not want to see them completely destroyed. I just want to see them relocated.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think in terms of any other, you know, actual takeaways that people can have on terms of, you know, what they can do or how to act smart, you know, I think would have to come from actual lawyers themselves. I really do hope that any lawyers who are listening to this, or if you know any lawyers who are sympathetic, that, you know, this can be shared with them and they can comment and share their ideas in the comments threads. Part two of the series is going to come out soon on your universal jurisdiction. Part three will come out after we get some feedback, and we can add to the list of ideas on how to use these concepts of war of lawfare. There's that. There is the question of whether you want politicized defense cases or not. The question of even just demanding the rights that are afforded to everyone else, but just people in the movement fail to demand. You know, I was really pleased to hear on a recent podcast, I heard John Angelo Gage talking about how he was accused of being a neo-Nazi in some media outlet by a university. And he had a lawyer. First of all, he has a lawyer, which I was really glad to hear. And second of all, he sent a cease and desist letter. And then the university retracted their statement, and they from then on called him a white nationalist. I think just... It's, to be really colloquial about it, I think a lot of people say, well, that sounds very Jewish, this kind of tactic. But, these are the tools at our disposal that we can use, and we can use them a lot more effectively than depending on, another kid with a bowl haircut to come along and start the revolution. So, I think there's another case in Hawaii. There was an Odinist who was, who was being denied her rights to practice her religion on an area where others, you do their religion, practice their own religion. These have to be demanded. We can't just sort of, cede that terrain and that battle space to the other side because, that's characteristically them, and we feel characteristically linked to a grand history of warfare. We should fight with 21st century tactics and the ones that will work and incrementally work towards victory and not have any overly romantic ideas about the same kind that say communists of the past would dream of the general strike or dispensationalists will dream of the rapture. We can't be another kind of sect like this. We have to be a serious political movement.
Well, that is a great way of ending this discussion. So thank you, Patrick, very much for your time. And I'm sure that many of our readers will be commenting on this podcast and on the Lawfare articles. And I think this is a very, very productive conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. Glad to be here and hope to be back soon.
Great. Thanks.